I'm David Halpin. I'm a retired orthopaedic and trauma surgeon. That's one thing. And since I retired a bit prematurely, I've been as active as I can be in speaking the truth about Palestine, about Dr. Kelly, about now currently the attempt to enslave our world population via COVID. And other things as well. If you look at my website, the website of David Halpin, if you just put in the search engine, David Halpin Surgeon, up will come a very full website. I think about everything I write, and I hope that everything I write is truthful. That's the end.
So, with David Kelly, he was, I believe, involved in the Porton Down, wasn't he? Which is Britain's Biological and Chemical Research Centre just outside Salisbury.
Yes, he was acting head for 9 years, I recall. And he wasn't, people think, Dr. Kelly, that he's a medical doctor. He wasn't. He was a doctor of science, so he was properly called doctor. And he also had he had a gong, CMG. Did you know that? Yes, he had a gong for some of his services to one of his great achievements, apparently, was debriefing that fellow in the Russian chemical weapons research facility. I forget his name actually now, but Kelly spent a long time with him debriefing him.
So what was he actually doing there as an acting head of Porton Down? He would have obviously been privy to quite a lot, including things like negotiating, really, I suppose, an end to his own job, because yes. There's a bigger attempt, yes. Certainly back in the 1990s and the noughties, to abolish chemical weapons all over the world. Yes. So, it's a bit bizarre, isn't it, to be head of a centre yes, that you're trying to abolish?
Well, don't tell me that we are only a defence facility. Porton Down exists, no doubt, for offensive purposes. And if you look at my website and, in fact, put Porton Down in the search engine, you will find some discussion of Porton Biopharm, which is owned, in fact, by the Secretary of State for Health of this country. And that produces, among other things...
Hang on. Is this Matt Hancock, the ex...
Yes. Okay. Yes, Matt Hancock. Previously, it was that awful fellow, Hunt. But it was all set up by a man called Brodie... in Victoria Street, I think, or part of Public Health England, I think it should be. He set up this company. But you need to know that this company, which I've written to my MP about it, but this company was producing anthrax vaccines for the Americans.
Well, that is defensive, isn't it?
Oh, of course it is.
Well, the idea to vaccinate someone against a possible biological attack.
No, but Tony... biological weapons were banned internationally years ago.
But surely defending against them is not banned, is it?
Well,
in case someone is cheating around, like the Chinese or something, the Russians.
All I can say is this, actually. This is important. In 2016, the FDA in America found that the products that they were making at Porton Down were inadequate in several respects. And they banned the import of more anthrax vaccine for use by the DOD in America. In America, and that ban continued for the next year. I don't know the end of it all, actually, but the idea that a company was on the science park, so-called, at Porton Down, producing anthrax to insert into fit young American servicemen of all colours, and that it was defective in several ways... contaminated, I think, actually, with rubber products, I think, from the capping of the ampoule, that's one thing, is extraordinary.
Why is it extraordinary
that the Minister of Health has a 100% share in it?
So that is the Ministry of Health, is it?
Yes.
So whoever is Minister of Health has got...
He inherits the major share in Biopharm, Porton Biopharm.
Why is anthrax important? What's the interest in anthrax for the military?
Well, anthrax is, no question about it, that anthrax is a very, botulinum, Bacillus anthracis, which produces pneumonic plague and bubonic plague. Bubo is a skin lesion, swelling. It is a very vile organism. And it's no doubt about it. If you think of Grinard, where they experimented on sheep with anthrax, I think during the Second World War, when they went back a few years ago, they still found the soil contaminated with the bacillus. That's, what, 70 years later.
Well, so how? Why is the military so interested? Is it particularly virulent, or is it? You know, does it? What happens if you catch? And how do you know if you're catching anthrax?
I don't know all the details, Tony, of the medical aspects of it, but it is a what I don't know how transmissible it is. It's certainly transmissible as an aerosol. I could go on to speak about the anthrax attacks in America, which I got very interested in, actually, and I tried to forestall it. Because I knew the whole thing stank. It stank from beginning to end.
Okay, so this is September the 11th, isn't it, yes. That certain politicians, yes, who were particularly active in questioning the official narrative immediately, or were thought that they might be, plus journalists, were sent packets of anthrax in the United States.
Yes, that's right. And so were postal workers there, and there was a neat case reports from Florida, where a lady produced about 50 years of age, she was a owner, editor of a freebie, I think, in New Hampshire, and a ex-British 70-plus-year-old, and a child. So we had a woman of middle age, an elderly male, and a child dying of anthrax. And I suggested then, I had a fear that this was going to be a trigger for World War III. They were going to say this was Iraq behind it. And in fact, Pearl, Lucifer himself, was saying it at the time. And I said, I wrote to the BMA, and I wrote to Hay, a bacteriologist involved with weapons research, I remember, up in, I think, Manchester, somewhere like that. I wrote saying that what should happen is there should immediately be a team of public health doctors, bacteriologists, and epidemiologists flown from Europe, particularly Scandinavia, for its potential independence, to America to look at the post-mortem reports and to see all the texts regarding those deaths, because I suspected that the ones in Florida were phony. And later on, as you know, it emerged, sort of, that the powdered anthrax came from Fort Detrick's.
So Fort Detrick, isn't that a sort of a military facility, a bit like the British Porton Down?
It, exactly. Fort Detrick's is meant to be a defence facility. There are several in America. There was one on Plum Island, and there's a story about that as well. This is not conspiracy theory. This is what people have said. Plum Island were researching bioweapons. It's off the coast of Connecticut. And it is said that Lyme disease was being looked at by Plum Island. And apparently, if you look at a colour map of America, of the most dense areas where Lyme disease, which is Borrelia, two organisms actually, one is Borrelia, I forget the other one, they're both, I think, motile organisms, but the disease rate from Lyme disease apparently shows the greatest concentration in the coastal areas opposite to Plum Island in Connecticut. Now, I haven't gone into that at all, but I just read it. Actually, he was saying it. There was a fellow called Romanoff writing in Global Research. He seems to have gone quiet. I hope he's still alive. He was writing, he wrote about 6 or 7 articles for Global Research in the early part of 2020. And he included this discussion of Plum Island then.
Now, your work on Kelly is, yes, really quite important. It's been involved in making sure that this whole idea of him committing suicide is not let lie and that there is some investigation. Yes. It's obviously very difficult for people to do that since all the details of that death have been embargoed, yes, for a very, very long time, until probably most of us have passed away. What about the various books on that? Because I think, isn't it, Norman Baker, the Lib Dem MP, and Miles Goslett have both done, over the last few years, published books on that. Do you think there's anywhere people can go if they really want to get to the bottom of the Kelly business?
Miles Goslett actually is coming here tomorrow with his family. They're on a holiday in Devon. He said how lovely it was to get away from London. I can imagine. But Miles is a staunch friend. He's not fully perceptive about who is in the Kelly story and who isn't. I don't mean that in a personal way, in a sort of nasty way, but he is an independent journalist who has exposed Kids Company. He really went for Thompson, who of the BBC, he was then Director General, I think. He interviewed him in America. In fact, it's on a Channel 4 YouTube, I remember, actually. And Miles went across to New York to interview him. He ended up in the street talking to him, actually. But Miles has truth within him. He can't stick what's going on, but of course he's got a young family. He has to be very wary about what story he picks up.
No, just a minute, because I think one of the main things he was involved in was the exposure of Jimmy Savile.
That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
This is Thompson. And it's very obvious, in fact, that the BBC...
What's the connection between Thompson and the Jimmy Savile affair then?
Thompson and some of the other people there in BBC top jobs did their best to conceal the story was emerging from that lady, Lean, I forget, and the very decent producer for one of the, I think, Panorama, I can't remember now.
You mean Liz McKean?
Liz McKean.
Because funny enough, I worked with Liz.
Did you? Well, she's a truthful person, you can see
she
that.
She was, yeah, she died, actually.
What?
Yes, she died. She died about, maybe 2 years after that whole affair.
What did she die of?
Not sure. But it certainly looked a bit suspicious that she was younger than me, actually.
She looked a fit woman when I saw her on television. There was a producer with her with a Welsh name. I just can't remember. I will remember it later on, actually. But it is no question that the BBC knew of Savile's most evil actions involving both young girls and young boys. Because he had a dressing room attached to the Jim Will Fix It, apparently the curtained arrangement, and the children would go in there before the show and they'd come out afterwards. And do not tell me that they did not have some knowledge of what Savile was up to.
Well, I mean, I was working at the BBC in the late 80s in central London, but not actually at Broadcasting House or Television Centre. And people I knew at the time and since, many of them, including people who were working on That's Life, had worked on That's Life, for example. Several of those I've spoken to much more recently that knew all about Savile. And there's also the question of the death of Jill Dando, because she was reporting to Paul Condon, who was the head of the Metropolitan Police at the time, a whole list of what she believed were paedophiles at the BBC, literally just about 2 months before she was then executed in a gangland killing, you know, effectively. Yeah. So this is something that I think is a sort of running sore still almost at the BBC, and the attempt to continually cover it up and keep this all, the whole, the fact that the BBC executives had knowledge of all this Savile business, quiet. But so anyway, this is another aspect
well,
of...
Well, Tony, what I would say actually is that I was right to assume that the BBC knew a lot about Savile for years. And Miles was very active in that. He tried very hard. Kids Company was another one, but he also, in fact, has stuck with the Kelly story as well. So Miles and...
What can you add, do you think, to Miles's book? Because it's the most recent one, isn't there? Just add a few things to it, if you can. A sort of little top-up for
anyone. I'll tell you the absolute top thing. This is the key. I'm not sure whether I've said it to George Galloway, who interviewed me here for about an hour and a half. The film was shown last Saturday, but I couldn't go because of my cellulitis. But this is the key, Tony. Kelly had been to Iraq 39 times with UNSCOM. It was mostly a spying mission. The CIA were in it, and they were taking coordinates, of course, of all the of Iraqi defence systems, which no doubt we'd supplied BAE, I can imagine. He wanted to go back to Iraq. They were taken out, as you know, UNSCOM in 1989. It was Opera and Desert Fox. Slick Willie started bombing Iraq again. They had to take out the UNSCOM inspectors because they'd be under threat, partly from recrimination.
No, we're talking about the early noughties here, before, just in the run-up to the Iraq War.
The illegal Iraq War. We're talking about run-up to the Gulf War One, actually.
Oh, okay. So before the first Gulf War.
It was, in fact, late 80s. Yeah, 1989, I think it was, actually. They were taken out. Desert Fox. Anyway, there's a lot I know about Gulf War One as well. But Kelly wanted to go back. It is said that he was in favour of the invasion of Iraq. I believe he was a moral man. I don't believe he was. I think the words are put in his mouth. He decided the Ministry of Defence arranged for a flight for him. He often had an ex-RAF Vulcan pilot as his minder. There's a story there as well of interest, actually. It hasn't emerged, actually.
And maybe, you know, he sounds like a possible rock crab, as they call, which are the intelligence associated with the RAF.
He might well have been in there to make quite sure Kelly stayed on the straight and narrow. I don't know. He, in fact, ended up buying a hotel restaurant in the same parish where Kelly lived. In fact, Kelly's daughter had a wedding at this hotel. So quite a close association there. This Modi is actually an email that he sent. But in May, and I forget the date exactly, he went to Heathrow for this flight to Kuwait, which was under the control of the Polish forces. Remember, there were 39 nations that were willing for the genocide of the Iraqi people. When he got to Heathrow, there was a question about his visa. And he was held up at Heathrow, and I think the flight was held up for a little while he sorted it out. As I pointed out, with Kelly's senior position in our germ warfare and chemical warfare establishment, a quick phone call would have fixed it like that. He got to Kuwait. He had his cell phone taken from him. He was put up in a hotel, and I think ensconced in the hotel, and he was sent back to Britain the next day. His daughter, Rachel, said he was very upset about it. Well, so would I be if I was Dr. Kelly. He went back to Iraq in June, and I forget the date then. I have the date. It's all written down. It's on my website. If you search David Halpin Surgeon and put in the search engine Kelly, there'll be 51 references, and they are all highly relevant, including my attempts to show that the pathologists, both of them, Shepherd, Professor, and Dr. Hunt, showed professional misconduct in their management of the case. The GMC deflected me. It wasn't even a doctor. It was just legal officers, so-called. Anyway, he was put up in some ramshackle regimental headquarters in Iraq. And I don't think he got out, as far as I know. Peter Beaumont of The Observer had a conversation with him, presumably by satellite phone. It was all about weapons. They'd found two vehicles in the desert, I think, which were on rubber wheels, actually, which the Americans were putting forward as a germ warfare machine. You can imagine, Sunday Times, there would be aerial photographs and diagrams of this structure. Peter Beaumont asked, the Iraqis were saying that they were simple machines. His actual words, as quoted, I think, by Beaumont, were, listen to this. The Iraqis, they are, this is Dr. Kelly, they are what the Iraqis say they are. They are machines for producing hydrogen for artillery balloons. Now imagine the sofa cabinet with those psychopaths like Blair, the paramount psychopath and war criminal, sitting there sipping his Sauvignon, Mandelson, Campbell, Powell, and the rest of them. Imagine when it comes through on the ticker tape or whatever, or email, Dr. Kelly has in fact spilt the beans about this weapon. This is the big find. Don't forget that the whole casus belli of the Iraq War was WMD. They found bugger all. And McKay, who was sent there from the Iraq Survey Group, ended up saying it's slam dunk, there are no weapons. So what Kelly had to say about this machine, now this is the key thing actually, Tony. This is absolutely key. I watched the film Official Secrets. There is a segment in that, only about 2 minutes long, which shows Powell, not well, Powell, you know, the Negro Secretary of State.
Colin Powell.
It shows him with a file, supposedly of plutonium, yes. At a Security Council meeting on the 5th of February, 2003, speaking about what the Iraqis were up to and they couldn't be trusted. He spoke specifically, and I've got the on my rather full computer, I have the text of his speech. It was very long. The Security Council was packed. The audience was full. All the seats were full. I didn't imagine that the Security Council had an audience normally, but it had some hundreds of people there. He mentioned that they'd found evidence of a machine for producing a germ warfare weapon on a tracked, i.e. railway, or a wheeled vehicle. That was on the 5th of February, 2003. In late May or early June, it was found. And Kelly said it's what the Iraqis said it was for. Do you know that the BAE sold it to the Iraqis, this machine for producing hydrogen, for laying artillery balloons? You couldn't make it up, Tony. And just imagine, that was in June. On July the 17th or the 18th, Kelly was found slumped against a tree in the wood at Harrowdown Hill, about 2 miles from his home. He liked to walk. He had his cell phone with him. We can go into all sorts of things. One of the key things is that Miss Holmes, who found him with his dog Brock, I think, in fact, the searchers were probably told where to look, I think, she found him slumped against a tree with some dry blood on his wrist. And she then spoke to Chapman, her senior in his lay search team, and he phoned Abingdon, and then the coppers arrived later. A man called Coe, who probably was MI5. He was in black fatigues. He was with one other. People saw three people, and a third with Coe. Coe denied until a Daily Mail confession in 2010 that there was a third man. He confessed in 2010 there was a third man. His name has never been revealed, but I'm quite sure he was there to set up the tableau to make sure that the scene for suicide was about right. It was, in fact, wrong in every respect. The fact is, when he got there, when the ambulance people got there, and the two ambulance people, I forget their names for a moment, Bartlett was one, and his lady, and his lady paramedic, they found him lying supine, the corpse, with enough space at the head end between the tree and Dr. Kelly's head for paramedic Bartlett to stand there and put leads on his chest to confirm death. I think his death was obvious. I don't think any need for cardiac leads at that point. But that's a fact. So the position he was found in by Miss Holmes, and she describes it completely. Hutton smears it, of course. He blurs it, bound to, in his... Mr. Hutton, thank you, Lord Hutton, thank you. Thank you, my Lord, 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 Lord Hutton. Thank you, sir. Oh, yes, that will do now. Thank you, Dr. Hunt. Hutton blurred that. The body was moved. And any policeman present at that scene should have said, stop, this is a criminal action, possibly. No further action should be taken. But instead, the police were putting around a story of suicide within that morning. And incredible. That morning, don't forget, that pal of Blair's, the Attorney General then, the Scotsman with a chubby face, what's his name? Falconer called Lord Hutton, the safe pair of hands from the Freemasonry of Northern Ireland, to his office in the House of Lords. He was called at about noon to discuss the setting up of an ad hoc inquiry, i.e. an inquiry which had no legal force and which would filter all the information. And that was Kelly's body was still cooling at 12 o'clock that day. He had an instruction from Blair, who was on flight en passage to Tokyo. He had an instruction from Blair to set up an inquiry. That's the story. But the key thing is what Kelly said to Peter Beaumont, and what they then revealed, that this was going to be the WMD, which was going to be the excuse for this war.
Let's just get back to Portendown, because a lot of it seems to come back to that, including much to do with this current plandemic, scamdemic, yes, whatever you want to call it. Portendown is the centre for much of this.
I don't know about that.
I think whether it comes to manufacturing, analysing, this is where, yes, it's all supposed to be done. Yeah. If this is, as I believe it is, an actual biological weapon. Yes. Let me just say a little bit about why I think that, and that is because if you were going to create a biological weapon of some sort, the first thing to do, if it was going to create a global pandemic, something which would spread very quickly and widely across the world, a little bit like the BBC's Survivors series in the 1970s, where you see the Chinese guy sniffling and then his passport being stamped as he goes around the world. It was a drama series, a very good drama series, the sort of thing the BBC don't do anymore. Mm. But focusing it on Portendown, I think, is quite useful and important. I mean, I worked in Salisbury for the BBC for a year as a reporter in Salisbury, digging up stories week after week for BBC Wiltshire Sound, and there was always a sort of an attitude about Portendown where these people are everywhere.
Out of bounds.
Well, they're all over the place under different fronts. That was one of the things I used to get from them. And one of the reports I did there was about this common cold research unit. Now, the coronavirus is, of course, a common cold. It's the sort of thing that makes you sniffle a bit. You hardly notice, yeah, maybe blow your nose a few, yeah, times and it's gone. Yeah. But it is incredibly transmissible. So if I were an evil person and I wanted to create a really nasty bioweapon, the mechanism to project it around the world could possibly be this coronavirus. Yes. It moves around very quickly. Yes. Now, what with a little bit of genetic engineering to put something nasty, yes, exactly, onto that coronavirus, yeah, would be almost the perfect way to create a man-made, global, yeah, pandemic, yeah, of some sort. Now, pandemic is a word that I wouldn't personally use, no, because I think it's something would have to be far more deadly than 0.02%,
exactly,
in order to be classed as a pandemic. This, I think, is much more like a bad flu. But anyway, can you just tell us what you think and know about this Common Cold Research Unit, which I did a report for the BBC on 1992-1993, just as it was about to be demolished. We went, walked around it. It was just a kind of shell. There were kind of weeds growing up around it. And before it was demolished to make a housing estate, and you can still go to that part of Salisbury and see a plaque in the wall, which says this is where the Harvard Hospital was created after World War II. This is where it used to be. I'm not sure if people have still got anthrax in their gardens from the Common Cold Research Unit or whatever. They would better watch out. But what was going on at this Common Cold Research Unit, and was it connected to Portendown?
Well, Tony, I went to school. I was a boarder at Shaftesbury Grammar School because I was one of three brothers living in one bedroom in our flat over Dad's business in Camp Vicliss in Bournemouth. So we were very close to Portendown, only about 20 miles away, I suppose, but Portendown was a shadowy place. They were then, in fact, having flights from there was a long airstrip there, and they were trying out various aerial vehicles. That was one thing. And sometimes there were reports coming in to us as schoolboys of night flights of unusual sort. That's one thing. When I was at Shaftesbury, there were quite a few boys whose fathers and mothers were involved in the services, and they were often a bit at a loose end in the holidays. And I remember that one or two of them were invited, I think it probably was a general invitation, to go as volunteers to the Common Cold Research Unit on Portendown. And I think one or two did, actually. I think one was called Rogerson, who went into the army later. But that was then. We also went to Portendown as part of our zoology teaching, or biology, or whatever it was, and we met a Dr. Smith there in his laboratory. It was all right friendly.
So you actually went, into Portendown itself?
We went to Portendown as schoolboys.
This is a what, 1950s?
This would be 1957, when I was sixth form. We didn't have a big sixth form. It wasn't a very bright school, but we had bloody good masters. They were inspiring people. And I was so glad I went to Shaftesbury Grammar School. And I loved Dorset. I'm reading Hardy at the moment. Oh, and I'm so pleased to come back to Hardy. His study of the human and his observation of the natural world beyond compare. So that's an aside. So I've now been focusing, I know quite a lot about Fortin Down. I knew it about 6 years ago. There was a case involving a soldier who was, they were experimenting with sarin on a cutaneous application, and this man died. And years later, after some long legal struggle, the case was brought forward, and it was found that there was foul play at Porton Down.
Now, hang on, because I interrupted you there. Can you just tell us, because you're actually going to Porton Down in the 1950s, just take us through that trip.
Well, I can't, Tony. It's a long time ago. We'd have gone by probably a little old bus that ran between Gillingham and Shaftesbury. I imagine there were about seven or eight of us. I suppose we had security clearance. Actually, it's having said that, it's very interesting, actually, that there was a chap in our sixth form called Lawrence. He was a bit different. He was a dissident voice. I was, in a way, but I suppose I was perhaps a bit quieter. But Lawrence, I remember, wanted to go into civil nuclear power. And MI5 came along to quiz him at the school. He spent an afternoon with him. I remember that. You remember him sitting out opposite the tennis court, just outside headmaster's study, this chap sitting with old Lawrence, you know, making sure he was sound or not. Perhaps he wasn't, I don't know. But that was then. But Porton Down, I've been studied it recently because I came across Porton Biofarm, an outfit that is owned by the Secretary of State for Health, HEALTH, health.
So, okay, so what about the current situation? We were a year on, really, 18 months, actually, from the outbreak of this. Last summer, July 2020, everything was relaxing. People were sort of thinking, oh, that's the end of it. All of a sudden, it kind of came back in the autumn. And the measures, for example, to do with masks, etc., came in, the, you know, strict social distancing, this kind of thing, became much more enforced. And we're now, back in July 2021, we're facing, okay, apparently it's all over, but we keep being told, well, you're going to have vaccine passports to do this. It almost seems as if, you know, 18 months after the outbreak of COVID-19, whether, you know, whatever you make of that, it's, things seem worse, actually, in a way, than they did just 6 months after.
It's getting worse all the while. The propaganda's getting worse. The mechanisms which they've instituted, like masks, there's no better way for the passage, for cross-infection, for transmission, than to wear dirty masks. Quite certain about it. And I think it's deliberate. I think that, actually. So I would call it a wittyism, not a witticism, but a wittyism. And don't forget that Valance, the so-called chief scientific advisor, sold his shares in Smith Kline French, but then I think bought them back in or something. But he has something like £600,000 worth of shares in the major pharmaceutical company. If he was on a parish council with 500 quid in the local builder's firm that was off being tendering for a village hall or something, he'd be off the council, wouldn't he? He'd have to resign. Here we tolerate, in this illusory democracy, a strange fellow called Witty, who looks possessed. I find out a bit about him. He was one of six boys. They all went to Malvern College, not a cheap exercise. His father was cultural attaché to the Greek embassy, I think during the time of the colonels, perhaps. And he was sadly blown up with two secretaries in a car. As you well know, Tony, there's all sorts of attachments, like British Council, what have you, where we have spies working in every country in the world. British intelligence is relied upon quite a lot by the Americans, as you know, as in Cambodia, which I think had a massive tonnage of bombs, but it was British intelligence which apparently was helping the Yanks then. So there we have it. We've got circumstantial evidence that there are people doing wrong things. The idea that people are experimenting to make viruses more transmissible or more deadly or whatever is extraordinary, and there are now people asking for a moratorium that all virus research should stop. I agree with that.
What about vaccines, though? Do you think there's very much difference between, for example, the Pfizer and Moderna have a what they call an mRNA vaccine. Yes. AstraZeneca is a different type of vaccine. There seems to be a very great emphasis on vaccines being the great solution.
No, vaccines are the coup de grace of the...
But vaccines in the past have been, haven't they?
I quote, when I write about it, if you look at my... I've written 46 articles on my website on COVID. If you search COVID, there are 39. Two interviews with you, Tony. And the last one actually is not on it, for some reason. I haven't got round to it, actually. But I've written 36, mostly for the local paper. But I jump before I push there because they're propaganda. You know, they're being paid, as you know, these full-page colour adverts. They're getting thousands of quids from us, the taxpayer, to pump out the rubbish. The vaccine, they're not vaccines anyway, but then I often say vaccine. I'm not anti-vax. Tetanus toxoid is a good example of a very useful vaccine. It's actually not a vaccine either. They take a fragment of the Clostridium tetanus organism and inject it into us, and it lasts a very long time, toxoid. They used to do it more often, probably because of getting a fee for it, but in fact it's known it lasts a long time. But death from lockjaw was very frightening, and it was real. The builder down here, working down here, Derek, age 72, his father died of lockjaw. You need to know that. And that hasn't happened. There was a lovely GP in Coffinswell near Torquay. I was introduced to when I first took the consultant job by my predecessor, Robin Ling. Dr. Movicker used to insist upon all the people in that valley having the tetanus toxoid because lockjaw was a common disease in this valley. A lot of horses. That was one of the key things, actually. But Movicker knew its value.
The horses were catching lockjaw?
No. The horses produced in their feces, in their muck, there's a lot of Clostridium tetanus spores.
Oh, okay. So
if you put a pitchfork through your foot, as I did once, actually, but I had already been immunized against toxoid, or a fork of some sort, but if you've been shifting horse shit beforehand, and you put it through your flesh, if you weren't immunized, your chances of getting tetanus was quite high. And when I worked in Bristol, I spent 2 years as a rotational, as a senior house officer, learning surgery. My first sort of surgical post after my house surgical job at Paddington General, later bulldozed, I worked at Ham Green. There was a tetanus unit there under a very skilled physician, Mick something, I forget his name actually, McCabe or something. There was also a geriatric ward or two, and there was a urological ward, so I was there. He used to do the fairly simple urology operations. I was there, and they were still getting in cases of lockjaw in 1986-7 when I was working at Ham Green. They had respirators there because they had to paralyze the patient. Had to give them Saxon or choline or so, I forget. Anyway, they had to paralyze them because they, you can imagine, that everything being rigid, including the chest, they had to ventilate them. So it was a very skilled operation. And they did recover, I think most of them. But there was a special unit at Ham Green, up a little pill, they call those little inlets from the Avon pills, at Ham Green for that purpose. So that's, I'm emphasising that vaccination can be very valuable. I'm told smallpox is another story to that, and the Chinese used to pass it on by insufflating it. They used to blow the powder from the cowpox lesion up the nostrils of supplicants who wanted to be immunised against smallpox. So there's a story from China, interestingly, well before Dr. Jenner, at Berkeley in Gloucestershire.
Oh, okay. So what we've got, though, is we've got this incredible industry that suddenly appeared almost out of nowhere. Now, as we know, the whole capitalist system is collapsing. We've got constant bailouts of nation, state, banks, big banks, etc. And with a sort of, I mean, I would describe as a Fourth Reich, actually, which is a kind of cartel system whereby all markets are carved up.
Yes.
And there is really all sorts of barriers to anybody new entering the market, yes. except at yes. a very, very low level. Yeah. So the idea is that in this sort of system is that you've got to keep constantly creating new markets out of yes. nowhere. You think about things like, yes. you know, congestion charges. Yes. Suddenly there's a market there yes. that, you know, lots of money is being made, tax is being paid, but actually this is something which is completely dreamt
it's
up out of nowhere.
It's a bubble.
So the whole COVID vax idea is we've got, as Bill Gates has quite clearly said several times, 7 billion people he wants to have double vaccinated every year with a COVID vaccine. That works out at something like £250 billion annual industry being created out of nowhere.
Yes, I know. Well, the thing is that I don't know the detail about this, but in fact, my neighbour down the road here, who was very much with me on the COVID thing, but then in fact tailed off. He got a bit tired, actually. He's a meteorologist, actually. So his wife, of a sort. But he said that, you know, medicine was bought by the Rockefellers about 30, 40 years ago. He's right. And big pharmacy dominates medicine. No question about that.
The thing is that people very rarely bother to trace who owns the stock in these businesses. They see, for example, they'll go down the street and they'll see a Texaco station. They'll fill up their car there and they'll see, oh, maybe the next week they'll see a mobile station is a bit cheaper.
Yeah.
and so that, but they don't understand necessarily that the same investors may own stock in both of those different companies. So they're really just an illusion, creating an illusion of competition.
Well, I can tell you this. If you go on my website, you'll find a correspondence with the Oxford Vaccine Group, who are responsible for producing the AstraZeneca so-called vaccine. It's not a vaccine, it's experimental inoculation. It hasn't gone through the phase 3 trials, which is a larger population. It's gone through a selected population, fitter people. It wasn't very rigorous. It hasn't involved children, but they now want to vaccinate, in inverted commas, children with the same thing. But my correspondence with the Oxford Vaccine Group is important, and it's on my website. I wrote to Heather House there. She was conscientious in the responses at first, but she has since, in fact, been silent on my last questions, because I wrote to the chief constable of Thames Valley Police, a man called Campbell, John Campbell, on the 4th of March, saying that they're proposing to vaccinate children in a trial. They already started, actually. I said, this is a criminal act, and as the major law officer, you should take action. I never heard back from the chief constable. But later, the trial on children was stopped. It was in Oxford and at 4 or 3 major DGHs, including King's College London. And I don't know why it was stopped, whether there was adverse effects, or it may even be my letter. I don't know. Maybe the chief constable had a word, say, here. We don't like this chap, Oddie, he's a dissenting, you know, always on the bloody, he's got a big website. He's saying that what you're doing is criminal. Tell me about it. It may be that, I don't know. They haven't told me why it was stopped. But listen to this, Tony, that it's put forward as a non-profit organisation. Miss Gilbert has recently been given, I think, a damehood or something like that, actually, some other damn thing. She was in the group. And another fellow, I think his name's Andrews, I think, they belong to Vaxi, V-A-C-C-H-I, no, V-A-C-C. Anyway, it's a stockholding company that's making money out of AstraZeneca. You couldn't make it up, Tony. There is no morality in it whatsoever. And when I was asked if I wanted the vaccination by my surgery about, March last year, I said, it's not necessary. I just very courteous. The girl, she misheard me. She said, oh, she said, good. I said, no, I'm sorry. I said, I don't want it. It is not necessary. That's all I said. But listen to this, Tony. I've had 12 letters from Mr. Hancock, and with some signed by Mr. Jendrick, another shyster like Hancock, telling me that I'm clinically extremely vulnerable. Even though I can do 10 hours manual work in my woods with good men, so twice a week sometimes. I am on thyroid, so many other people. I have had interrupted, intermittent atrial fibrillation, common in people over 70. As it happens, the drug which is preventing it happening, I stopped when I became ill and was in hospital last week, and I haven't, I'm in sinus rhythm now, 6 days from stopping the drug I was taking, quite rightly, in fact, to stop the AF. You always feel a bit below par, and the risk of AF is you can get a stroke. So I'm on anticoagulants. But for some reason, the surgery, who apparently designated me extremely vulnerable, won't tell me why I was designated that way. But I've had 12 letters. Think of the cost of this alone. I've had an email from someone at the Ministry of Health, and I had a homework from near Manchester, a young woman who listened to me, actually, and was probably reading my website, who asked me why I wasn't having the vaccine. So I've had 14 communications to David Sidney Halpin of Haytor on the edge of Dartmoor about my health. Consider, what Minister of Health has ever written to a patient before like that? It is extraordinary. But people think it's ordinary. They're mad. We have a large moronic element in our population.
I don't think, personally, I've ever seen anything like the attempt to use the news media, which is supposed to be unbiased, impartial questioning, to actually sell a new product to the public. I've never seen anything even close to what's been going on with the vaccine. So I see news stories on news bulletins of somebody, for example, telling the viewers how happy they are that they've had a vaccine.
How brave they are.
How wonderful it is, including actually my own aunt on ITV News.
Coventry Hospital.
This sort of thing, I think, you know, to me it doesn't smack of honest journalism, it smacks of advertising and an encroachment, really, of the advertising media into the newsrooms. I think, have a fairly similar point of view about having not really, what we're seeing is not really the proper reporting of adverse effects. Now, that's partly due to the very informal system which is used to register adverse effects of these vaccines, where it's almost sort of blasé.
Yes.
Well, you can actually, if you navigate the internet, if you've got your internet connection, you've got the time and the patience to work with it, that you can actually actively yourself you can actually go onto the VAERS system, VAERS system, and you can say there's been an adverse reaction to my vaccine. Many people, of course, the first thing they do is that they just simply inform their doctor. Many of those doctors then do nothing with that information, so that's a waste of time. The doctors have got either too much to do, or they'll take maybe a mental note of it, put it in your records, but it won't go into any kind of official place where it's then published. So there seems to be, both through the bias in the national press and local press, against reporting adverse reactions to the vaccine. But anyway, so what about what you have personally witnessed as a retired doctor, retired surgeon? What have you seen?
Well, I've seen quite a lot, Tony, but this is against a background where I've been telling people for months not to have the so-called vaccination, because I've been in contact with people like Mike Heaton, who've spoken honestly. They're truthful people. They are deeply concerned about inserting spike protein into people's bodies using the messenger RNA, or in the AstraZeneca case, just taking fragments from a stew produced from a fetal kidney produced from a medical abortion. Often there's often the reasons for the medical abortion are phony. About 40 years ago, it's been grown on in cell culture. So the stew from which they're making the AstraZeneca vaccine involves, first of all, a chimpanzee, adenovirus in chimpanzee. Then it involves the production of fragments of something or other, of small strings of protein, probably quite large strings, in a soup in a laboratory. In fact, it's been outsourced, as you know, to India, partly. But they've been as you know, they only started trials on these so-called vaccines in June or July of 2020, and within 5 months they were getting approval from the FDA in America and getting approval like the drop of a hat here.
Well, the vaccines were even in the distribution centres before approval was even given to them.
Rather like the sleepers for the bonfires of foot and mouth animals were ordered 6 months before the actual outbreak. It's a similar, quite a good analogy actually there, really. I didn't know about that actually, but I the thing is this, that the whole thing stinks. You can see how it stinks in the simplest way. Anyone with intelligence, with some intelligence, would see the propaganda and say, what is this costing us? On a Thursday in June of last year, there were 5 full-page colour adverts in every national and local paper throughout the land. That would have cost millions. They weren't doing it for free. And I wrote to my MP then, a slug called Mr. Mel Stride, previously a political advisor to another slug, David Cameron. He's been our MP for Central Devon for some years now. I think it's 2010, I think. I wrote to him, "Dear Mr. Stride, would you please tell me the cost on this one day of the propaganda and of the other costs of the propaganda, which was wall-to-wall on BBC, independent media, Classic FM, a lot of it." I have not had an answer since June of last year. I've had bleak references. The last one was from Undersecretary of State, a Tory MP. I forget her name actually now. Fitzsimmons, I can't get a name, but a useless reply. But he's chosen not to tell an intelligent, questioning constituent who's written to him before on other things. He knows me very well. I met him once in a very strange interview with his agent, Nucky, N-K-U-C-K-E-Y, Mr. Nucky. Met him in the Exminster Village Hall. Strange place to meet. I drove up there. The interview was about 10 minutes long. He was in a hell of a rush. I think he wanted to see what I looked like, I think. Something, it's the most strange thing. He has not answered me. The fact is they've spent millions and millions on the propaganda, and we are paying for it. And they don't. The thing is, what I find so extraordinary, Tony, is that the average layperson, they know it. They must know it's some propaganda, but they don't even care that we're paying for it.
Do you think there are some older generation that do take quite a sceptical view about all this and see it as almost like a cult?
Yeah.
The human cult?
I have a very good friend called Miriam Stevenson. She was a social worker for children in Sheffield. She's married to a man who was a GP, and he became a professor of general practice or some allied subject. And he's been in Sydney, Australia, where there's another story, as you probably know, about people becoming HIV positive with a trial there of a vaccine, the University of Queensland, in combination with the Chinese. People have had the vaccine there in a trial, and they've become HIV positive. Imagine what that does to your life insurance chances then, actually. It is beyond belief. But Miriam she's humble origins. She's got 2 sons, one who's studying law at Cambridge. Miriam writes me almost every day, giving me extra stuff. You can send me too much stuff. I've seen the evil of it from the word go. I said they were engendering a feeling of end times, of Armageddon, with this, what they were saying in the beginning of 2020. And you remember I'll just say it before I finish. Miriam said to me, she said to her mum, she was discussing this, you know what her mum said? She said, they're having this business instead of World War III. She's right on the nail. This is World War III, but I'm afraid, as you know, Tony, that this is that underneath this vast distraction, this bending of people's minds, the ruining of their bodies and their health by a concoction out of a cauldron in these vile laboratories around the world, they are excavating people's minds. People have become mindless. It's so obvious. When I went to Asda to pick up my second antibiotic on Monday, There were a lot of young people there coming in and out of the checkouts. I was waiting at the pharmacy place for a quarter of an hour while the decent people dealt with me there. 85% were masks, even though it was a hot day. All the staff were wearing masks. One said she was doing it to protect herself. But that's what we're dealing with. It is extraordinary how people have obeyed a cabal of psychopaths.
What about specific effects due to the vaccine? What have you seen recently?
Right, well, today I must remain anonymous because I haven't had his permission yet to speak about it, but this man has been made ill by the vaccine. I heard about him from...
How do you know it's the vaccine that's made him ill?
I'm absolutely certain of it. And I'll tell you the sequence of events, because what has happened to him is extraordinary. You have to explain things by unknown pathology. I'm good at pathology. I got a prize in it as a student. And I say that if you are a good pathologist as a doctor, you have X-ray eyes. When you see sick people, you can see into them what's happening.
What is a pathologist?
A pathologist is someone who examines the systems of the human being and of animals when things go wrong. That's a simple way to put it.
So, sort of diagnosis, plug it in, and this is what's wrong with you.
Yeah, well, no, you look at the, you have autopsies, you have bacteriology laboratories where you grow bugs from people's noses and elsewhere on agar plates and the rest of it, and blood, all sorts of things. You have what I had in my education at St. Mary's, where they found penicillin, Fleming, in 1933. I had the best education as a student, 1958 to 1964, when I qualified. A hospital which was inspiring, where there were real experts. The immunologist was a wonderful chap called Ken Porter, later became a well-deserved Nobel Prize winner, often undeserved, as you know. But Ken taught us about immunology. So I know about immunology. He was inspiring too. We learned about viruses, about fungi. We even had our own mycologist at Mary's, a little Welshman called Davies, who knew all about the diseases which funguses can cause, like Aspergillus fumigatus, which can cause a nasty cyst in the lung, black, because it produces black spores. So things like that, and also epidemiology. That wasn't so well taught, perhaps, but epidemiology is common sense. That's the fact of it.
Going back to your case. Anonymous case.
Right. Okay. He had the AstraZeneca vaccine on 28th of February of this year. He knew I was sceptical because I was friendly with him, friendly with his wife. He had the jab. I said, why did you have it, Bill? Why did you have it? He didn't really know, actually. But he said, you know I was sceptical, don't you? But I have to say to people who are sceptical still, you prefer to believe people like Johnson rather than me, a well-trained medical practitioner. I'm retired, long retired, but I maintain interest in every aspect of medicine. I love medicine. It was great fun getting people better, getting people walking again after with their rotten hips, getting them seeing they're looking 10 years younger a few months later, their spouses would say, enjoying a walk without having to take Panadol beforehand, using a stick or elbow crutches or whatever. They're now, in fact, thousands and thousands of them will be waiting for years because of this bloody COVID nonsense. Terrible. The backlog of people waiting to be seen for a diagnosis, 14 million. There were 300,000 waiting with cancer symptoms or potential cancer symptoms. Some of them will have had cancer. Some will have gone to a more advanced stage and had more difficult surgery. Some will die of it more when they wouldn't have died of it. But Bill, going back to this one, well, his name is not Bill, actually. His name is, in fact, well, he's got another name. We call him Bill
a good way to anonymize.
As an animal, exactly. He had the vaccination. He felt a bit rough for a few days. Then he became deaf in his left ear. He'd had a hearing test, as it happens, about a year before. He was found to be about, say, 10% deaf in this ear, I think. He now regards the hearing in this ear as about 30% normal. In the right ear, he became almost totally deaf in sequence. This has been reported often on the artificial intelligence gathered MHRA website. But as we know, it is grossly underreported, all the adverse effects. A Harvard study with some other independent organisation found that the number of cases being referred to the CDC were between 1 and 10% of the actual adverse effects. 1 and 10%. In this country, they're not telling people when they line up without informed consent for the so-called vaccination. I call it inoculation, to give it a rather more generic term. They're not told about telling anybody about adverse effects. They're not told about the yellow card system, which I wrote opposing about 40 years ago as a useless system when I was a young doctor in training in surgery, I think, then. Had a dusty reply from Herxheim, who ran this bulletin, I said it should be any drug or vaccine should be put into a controlled population, say Bournemouth or Sidford or something, Sidmouth, and then studied proactively, very carefully, before it was released for general. What they do, they let it become general, and they rely on this useless yellow card system. It's been going for about 60 years. Coronavirus, by the way, was found, the family of viruses, in the 60s, when I was still studying medicine. But I've studied medicine ever since, as you can gather. They've tried to produce vaccines against coronaviruses. They've always failed. Always failed. And their last big trial was on ferrets, and they all died, apparently, of respiratory disease, I think. So we're dealing with a lie of massive proportions. People are making big money out of it. People are being made sick. This man went on after he had became deaf. He then...
This is, yeah, back to Bill, yeah.
Back to Bill, anonymous synonym Bill. Back to Bill. He later then, in fact, had... he had discharge from one ear. He says it's a rather waxy material that comes out.
So is this... at which point he's thinking about possibly having a second jab?
He's been all over the place. He's had the second jab. He had the second jab in May. And I can't... he's going to write me a timeline on the... He has my email address. I know that already. Because I know him quite well, actually. And I heard they're very fond of going elsewhere in the country. And I said to him, to her, actually, because she was on the line. She is a friend of Susan's. I said, you should not go to Scotland for your holiday. You should see an ENT surgeon who's seen a lot, because I don't like the sound of your story. I thought he had blocked eustachian tubes, actually. I didn't know about the vaccine then. I didn't know he had the jab, I didn't think. Anyway, I found him a name of an ENT surgeon in Exeter with a Ashkenazi name, but he'd been in post for a long time. I thought, well, he'd be a good chap to see him if he had eustachian blockage. You put a tube into the back of the nasopharynx, and you put a bit of air in it, unblocks the eustachian. It will follow catarrh, you know, that sort of thing, so clear catarrh. Subsequently, listen to this. This is horrific, Tony. It almost makes me weep. He then developed blisters under his foreskin. It went on to become a necrotic condition. He's seen all sorts of people, often A&E, you know, uselessly, going to A&E about a thing like that. But anyway, he sees urologists.
This is because he cannot get access to specialists through GP.
Well, partly so. The GP's not seen anybody. They've been told not to see people. It's as definite as that. If you look at the websites of general practice, they're full of blue font from the Public Health England. And they don't see anybody. They ask you to send photographs of the skin lesion, or they is on the phone, like today. But I am seeing my doctor later on today about my cellulitis of my right leg. Eventually, someone at Torbay, urologist, said, I don't like the look of this. It looks like cancer to me. And they took a biopsy. I think it perhaps showed some cancerous cells. He was referred to a specialist in Bristol. He examined him. I think this man actually is conscientious, but he thought that he was suffering from just forgotten the eponym Fournier's gangrene of the genitals. He's had part of his glans penis, that's the head of the penis, removed, part of the body of it. He's a man who's still very sexually active, but even so, forget that, the penis is quite useful. I just use it, in fact, to pee into the toilet here. You probably can't pee straight now. That was one thing. His antibiotics, he could reel off the ones he's had from that. He's seen dozens of people. but no one has mentioned the vaccine as being connection. The last thing that's happened to him is that he developed a little swelling over his Achilles tendon. I forget which side it is now. He has a dressing on it now. This developed and eventually became larger. I think it was dark in colour. And he was seen somewhere, A&E, I think, actually. No, in the minor injuries unit. And the doctor who saw him said it ought to be lanced, incised. The male nurse who did it was very reluctant and was a decent man, apparently. I don't know if he had local or what, but it was incised and blood came out. He has now got a sore over his Achilles tendon, which might involve the tendon. The tendon doesn't have the best blood supply. That's why I never used to repair it, or hardly ever did. I used to avoid that because infection of a repaired TA was quite common. And he showed me an image of it taken recently. There's a ulcer over the Achilles tendon. I'm not sure whether you can't see a tendon. It's pussy. It's surrounded. The skin around it is red. He's having all sorts of potions put on it. That's the last thing he said. He is apparently, according to the wife, rather depressed. So would I be. But he's an intelligent man. He now regrets, of course, having the vaccination, not listening to me. I didn't tell him directly, but he would have heard through the grapevine that David, up at Kilnshots, is against anyone having any vaccine, particularly children, because it's not necessary.
OK, so there is a very important question here, though. I mean, elderly people get ill. I mean, these things can happen. I want you to explain why you believe that this is definitely due to the vaccine.
Because it followed in time, closely. He was ill to start with. He became deaf. That's been reported now in many people on the MHRA website, even though they're probably reporting a minority of the adverse effects. But the vertigo, which he's also had, things are going round. Dizziness, deafness, they're all reported separately on this artificial intelligence web. They had to outsource it. They knew they had lots of reports, they thought, probably benign reports. I don't know what they thought would happen, but they outsourced it, and this AI company put in a whole range of things. Some of it's a rag bag of diagnoses.
Well, the main reason it seems to use AI is because they don't want humans involved in the process, because if it's got humans putting together this database of adverse reactions to the vaccine, then there are potential people that the BBC could interview if they weren't stopping interviews.
And they're manipulating the adverse reactions as well. I can prove that. I've been examining that every week. But I doubt some of it. I notice that they have been underreporting stroke. I have left this man today, a different name, in this parish, having shaken hands with him. I said, Bill, you have what you've described is all being described now. In fact, he'd had on YouTube a report a week ago from India, where they're seeing skin lesions, cutaneous lesions, like he has had in the thousands from the Delta variant, supposedly. But as you know, Tony, the vaccination does not protect you from COVID-19 or its variants. No, no. The paper from Israel, which has been criticised, says that 60% of the people presenting with acute COVID have been vaccinated. And don't forget that early on, they were telling people who'd had the jab, don't forget Johnson's slogan, a jab in every arm, that when Johnson, he used to say that that after the jab, they should go on wearing a mask. Remember that? You couldn't make it up, Tony.
The inventor of the mRNA vaccine, one of the original chaps, doctors who helped to do that, it wasn't him, it was somebody else, has pointed out recently, has pointed out that the countries which have got the highest outbreaks of cases of COVID at the moment are the ones that have had vaccination.
I didn't know that. I think I have heard it, but Tony, to be frank, I'm part of a group, in fact, two groups actually now, there's too much discussion. When you see evil, you must confront it. You mustn't discuss it for too long. Some people don't get it. They don't get how evil it is or how dangerous it is, a vaccination. But there's no question, in the case of Bill, there was a close relationship in time, and the fact is this, the pathology in him is very, very unusual. It doesn't happen naturally. This is a fit man who can drive about. He's a very vigorous gardener. They were previously in the house just down the road from here. He made the garden suddenly, and within a few weeks, suddenly it was a better garden. He's a vigorous chap, normal diet, healthy wife, healthy fellow. He's got two children. One, I won't tell you what she does to identify him. Another one actually is an occupation in the health services. She has been very ill since COVID of last year. And so have two of her three children.
So have they been vaccinated too?
No, they haven't. They weren't. I don't think they've had the jab. But she is very ill from what people are calling long COVID. Now, long COVID, there'll be all sorts of neurotic things, all sorts of things. There's no doubt at all that some people suffer long-term effects from this virus. The fact is this also, Tony, that they make it sound as if loss of sense of smell or taste is a key indicator of COVID. It does cause it, but I know very well that other viruses can cause. They're so toxic that they can affect the olfactory nerves at the top of your nose, where in fact the swab can be stuffed sometimes and cause meningitis. I know it can destroy taste. I know that viruses can cause cardiomyopathy. One of my anaesthetic colleagues, a wonderful chap, his wife ended up with a cardiomyopathy, a weak heart from a viral illness, and he had to nurse for the last 18 months of her life, which he did with loving care. So the fact is that viruses, some viruses are very toxic. They can kill you. And if you're frail and elderly, the flu can kill you. But I will not have the flu vaccination. I'm 81, ever. I will certainly never have anything called COVID vaccination.
When I was reporting on really vox popping people who were attending one of the very first demonstrations yes. against all this in Stroud,
good place
in
Stroud.
2020, yeah. There was a German lady there who's married to an Englishman living in Stroud, and she said this is very similar to what they saw in Eastern Europe when they had to visit their friends in East Germany, for example, this yeah. very strict systems yeah. That don't really make sense to didn't make sense to her at the time, that seemed to be there to sort of as a police state yeah. to sort of intimidate
the
people.
Starving, yeah.
yeah, so she what she described as what she believed was happening was a new kind of medical dictatorship. As a doctor, how do you think is it possible to defeat that kind of malign influence on the world? Because obviously it's not just Britain, you know, and the developed world, Europe, United States, etc. The whole world is being taken down this road. What's the best way, do you think, to defeat it?
Well, there's several ways. First of all, I refer to St. John's Gospel, where the truth will set you free. It's a good quotation, actually. You get it from the website very easily. That's one thing. The truth is coming out. I've been optimistic from early on. Actually, my people I correspond with saying it's lovely writing with you, speaking with you, David, because you always give us hope. So I'm hopeful. The second thing is that there's so much side effects of this vile inoculation program that will just emerge. In this village alone, 2 weeks ago, I heard that the 24-year-old son of a couple who live in Liverton, just down the road from here, but who was working in London, he had the vaccine, he died of clots. I don't know anything more about the details, but all I know, in fact, is that there is a consumption coagulopathy. People, they're finding thrombocytopenia, I think almost universally people who are vaccinated, the platelets drop because the platelets are being central in the clotting process, as they were in Dr. Kelly. And they accumulate because of the damage to the intima, the lining membrane of the blood vessels, where clots form. You may get little thromboses causing a rash. You might get something bigger, maybe like Bill's thing over his kidney tendon. That might be an end artery. It's not a very... I've always known it's not a good place for vascularity over the heel. You can, for chilblains is a good example. That's, they happen because young women who are living in cold properties and don't wear enough clothing, they get these chilblains, and that's because of sensitivity to cold in the small arteries there. So it may be that Bill had a thrombotic episode over his Achilles tendon. He's had no rash, but a test called a D-dimer would have shown whether he was clotting or not, but he hasn't had that done. But he's got two... What's happened to his penis is beyond imagining. You know, you can overemphasize the importance of the male organ in the male. They're very, you know, that's a big factor in the male psychology. But the thing is, it's a useful organ. And it isn't without its own sort of, you know, it's quite a nice thing, actually. It's an attachment. It's untidy, but it's useful. It's useful for procreation. It's useful for urination. And, you know, I have an intact penis, and I'm quite pleased it's intact.
but what you're saying, really, is that as the effects of this vaccine are made known, that people will become much more aware of this medical dictatorship. Yes. But the problem, of course, is the media are really sitting on that. They're trying very hard to control everything to do with the perception. And, of course, we're also in the situation where all sorts of other things may then layer over this in the future to distract
people. Yes, distractions.
Getting to the bottom. A bit like the way that the September the 11th attacks are sort of forgotten about.
Exactly.
The idea that this was really a kind of self-harming incident in order to make an excuse to have foreign wars has been so-called forgotten about. So we may be dealing really with the press as the main vector of the problem as it rolls out.
The word is, and I'm seeing the lady from that you met in Stroud. Stroud's a thinking town. I've been there talking about Palestine, actually. I went there once, some decent people there. The word is fascism. And if you want to see the definition of it, as per Halpin, it's on my website. It's fascism. And that is that there is absolute state control, and I say it in my piece, an overweening state. And people resort to self-preservation. They stop thinking, they do as they're told, and the key quote, which I sent around for about 15 years, but I hardly ever get a response from it, is Milton Mayer. It's on the front page, on homepage of my website, down a little food for thought. And Milton Mayer, in a book, he was a son of a Jewish family that got out of Berlin in 1936, went to America. He became a journalist, and as a young man he went back to Germany about 1948, and he spoke to a whole raft of Germans who'd been there, and he then in fact analyzed how you could change the mind of an educated population, essentially Christian, either Catholic or mostly in fact nonconformist or whatever, how you change a nation piece by piece since the false flag of the burning of the Reichstag in 1933, and how Hitler came to power by removing every law. Consider this, Tony, that the bill which was passed on the nod on the 23rd of March of last year, do you know what the title was originally? The original title was the Coronavirus Bill, the 2019-2020 coronavirus bill. I've deduced from that, given it's 340 pages, it's the most complex, draconian bill. There will be drafting lawyers and House of Commons committees in the latter part of 2019 at least, when people were suffering from COVID. In the local pubs I used to talk about, they said, oh, Dave, we had it last year, 2019. And I've got a young chap who I know very well, who I supply logs to, and he had it in November. And he doesn't like doctors, very quite right too. He stayed at home, his wife nursed him a bit, and he later had bronchopneumonia, about 10 days later. People could have that following COVID, one of the causes of death. But they're relying on general practitioners who don't actually see the patient. So I've in a cleaner in the ward where I was for 3 days, Royal Devon Exeter, being cared for wonderfully by nurses and by the young doctors there and by the consultant as well. He's a little bit diffident, I found him, but It was good. The cleaner, normally on orthopaedic wards, a chap called David, another David, his name will come to, it doesn't matter, David Forward. He was punctilious in the way he was cleaning the ward, Lowman ward, and I congratulated him. He was doing things I always said should be done on a ward, which often weren't, because we had managers to discuss things with. Anyway, David had it in March of last year, I think. He's a fit man. He runs about 50 miles a week. He likes the outdoors. He's not a man not of the highest intelligence. He was in the army for 4 years, but then got out of that. Deaf. The officer said, don't wear ear defenders. You won't hear the orders. So in the glosses, he was made deaf by a nitwit officer, no doubt public school or educated, so-called, who decided that the soldiers should be made deaf by the sound of the shells going off. You couldn't make it up, Tony. And this is the fact. He was so ill, his wife, in fact, knelt beside the bed, I think praying for him. He was ill for about 10 days. And they phoned a GP. What happened, do you think, when they phoned a GP? Take plenty of fluids. He wasn't seen by a GP. But when I was a lad, and I had a few viral illnesses as I was growing up, particularly at boarding school, a GP would turn up in a suit, smelling of antiseptic a bit. He had cold hands and a warm heart, and you imbibed from his presence a feeling of professionalism and of confidence and of, well, professionalism. He was there to care for you, and he gave you his advice. He took your temperature. He listened to your lung basis to make sure you hadn't got pneumonia. That fellow David could have been dead with bronchopneumonia. If he just, in fact, listened to his GP. Well, in fact, all he had, he recovered because of his own immune system, which I learnt about as a good student at St. Mary's in 1959 from people like Ken Porter.
David, can you just remind us of your website, where people can find it, how we can follow of your work?
You'll have to look up it comes up easily. If you just put David Halpin, H-A-L-P-I-N, surgeon, up comes it. There is another David Halpin. He's of a different order. He's a professor of respiratory medicine in Exeter. He is a chairman of the Senate, another structure to destroy our health service. And although I'm sure he's a good respiratory physician, he has a different view about the health service than me, I believe. So I'm afraid that when you see David Halpin, up comes. But another confusing thing is David Halpern. Do you know who he is? He's the head of the Behavioural Insights team, otherwise known as Nudge Unit, in Victoria Street. And he is there to advise SAGE. He sits in on the SAGE meetings, and he will tell Mr. Johnson that the time is right. The people's minds have been so excavated that they're now susceptible to your ghastly propaganda. And he will, week by week, tell them how well they're tweaking it. He will be seeing CCTV images, footage outside supermarkets, petrol stations, showing that 99% are wearing their bloody masks, their filthy masks. And he would say, we've got them. So will you continue with your propaganda? And Mr. Stride, don't answer David Halpin as to how much it's costing, because we'll tell them later how much tax you're going to have extra, like they're now doing.
I mean, it almost seems that society's been divided into the sheep and the goats.
Yes, yes.
The people who believe in this and don't. And there's not a lot all that much in between. There's quite a lot. The British way is a bit, shall we say, reserved. So we will sort of do what we think we ought to do until we get to the point where we realise we're really not going to do that anymore. So we've got a kind of divided society, and this is not finishing anytime soon.
I want to say this, actually, that from early on, I've been speaking to the people on the checkouts in our agricultural stores, Mole Valley, Plants Galore, very good plant supermarket, excellent actually, it's got better. Other people, they light up when they say, don't wear a mask, you should look at my website, this is a lie, disease exists, I haven't denied that disease doesn't exist, but what is being told you is all lies, and you must not go along with it. Some light up. I can think of quite a few, and I've produced an A4 leaflet that I gave out to these people as well, actually. So I know that what I call the common man and woman, those people often on 0 hours contracts, those people who live almost hand to mouth with their wages and their little salaries, a lot of them know that it's wrong. I'll tell you finally this little story. I went down to get my prescription in the winter time. As I came back over the moor, there was a lad walking down on the opposite carriageway. It's a narrow road up towards Buckland, actually, Buckland the Moor. But it was in the dark, and he had dark clothing on. I thought, Christ, this chap's liable, if it's a drunk driving, to be knocked over and killed. So I went up to T-junction. I turned the vehicle round, my pickup as it was. I went, I opened the window, said, would you like a lift down to Ashburton? He said, yeah, that's very kind, whatever. He got in, and we had a brief chat, about 5 minutes' journey down the hill into Ashburton, where he lives. I said, what do you think of the COVID thing? And then the schoolboys know, school children often know, by the way. They see their parents watching the BBC and they're aghast because they know it's all lies, mostly. You know what he said is he got out. So I said, what do you think about the COVID thing? He said, it's all a game. And that's the message. There's a lot of people just waiting for leadership. And when they hear what side effects are being caused by it, we will find that Mr. Johnson, Hancock, Priti Patel, all the fascists, Patel especially, now banning anyone coming by dinghy across the thing from wars that we've caused with their dear children, banning people against the Charter of United Nations, where people should be given asylum, doesn't have to be official. If people are seeking succour in another country, they should be given it. No racism. They're human beings. Just think of those children dying, drowning, that little one who was found on the shore of Syria. Think of Mr. Johnson in 2013 when he was laughably a foreign secretary. He was over in the Middle East. He's already declared his love of Zionism. He's got Zionist connections. But he said, over in the Middle East, that Britain was out to topple Assad. That is against, that is a fundamental crime against the Charter of the United Nations. That is to incite aggressive war. My website is full of Syria. If you search Syria, there's some very, very interesting stuff on it, actually. Some lovely stuff, actually. Because I
mean, you could look at Syria and you could say, well, the West has been defeated by the Russians in Syria, and maybe they have now turned on their own population.
No. The whole thing. I wrote to the father of President Assad's wife, rather pretty lass, who went to public school here, I think, actually, pretty well English educated. I think she's a good wife, I think. They have one or two children. I wrote to him, I forget his name, Mohammed something. He was a cardiologist at the Wellington, one of the private places, and elsewhere. He spoke with patriotism, advising his son-in-law how he should conduct the insertion of terrorists into his country. I wrote to him, I've never had a reply. Don't tell me my letter to him wasn't intercepted. I had a wonderful letter from a girl called Jill. She's born in Torquay, 12 miles south of where we're speaking now. She fell in love with a Syrian psychiatrist who was training here in psychiatry. I can't think of he was being trained very well, because I don't think British psychiatrists had hot. And they went back to Syria. Syria, in fact, has looked after mentally ill people for longer than we have, for centuries, actually. They have hospitals, a hospital in Damascus, which has fountains playing, where there's peace and quiet, and it's the sound of water when people are trying to heal their minds. She wrote to me, she said, I've come across your website. I've been looking for people who are speaking the truth about my country. She's living there. She's lost a brother-in-law, Shell. They're firing these ghastly people. The people who would decapitate a 13-year-old boy for refusing to sell coffee in a souk to one of these so-called rebels. She's seen it all happen in her own family. She wrote me a lovely letter. It's on my website, and I actually published it with her information, with her acknowledgement. I wrote back to her. I said how warm it was to hear from her. But she said she liked the fact I was speaking truthfully about what was happening. And she then related what was happening in her own locality of Damascus. I wrote back to her. I never heard from her since. I bet email connections between this country and Syria have been cut by the fascists running our country.
Well, this is it. Quite a lot of people are on these Gmail accounts, which really it's like sending something into a big black hole. Anyway, David Halpin, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you, Tony, very much. I like the fact that you speak the truth. The truth shall set us free.